Dear God, may the words of my mouth and the meditations of all our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. Getting even can be delicious. How often do we think in retrospect, I should have just said this or that? That would surely have gotten him or her. Retribution has its own furnace that seems stoked by some goblin deep in the cellar of our hearts. Behaviorists speak of the fight or flight response to fear and injury, and for many, the fight comes easily, and others are off in a flash. The getting even, standing up for yourself, fighting back, metering an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, these are somewhat ingrained responses to wrongdoing that succeed in an odd way by affirming our self-respect. In some sense, when we retaliate, when we say, I'm worth more than that, you may not hurt me, part of our institutional concept of justice is predicated on the idea that perpetrators should get their due. The danger, of course, is that vengeance can also unleash a response out of proportion to the original infraction. It's justice has at its very heart a kind of built-in equivalency. The more insidious danger of vengeance is that those seeking retribution can come to resemble their despised perpetrators. Reciprocal acts of violence brilliantly seal individuals and societies in cycles of revenge, in closed systems of revenge and recrimination. They become their own food supply in a very efficient, sustaining environment. We are living in times that seem especially combative and fractious. The political climate is changing hourly in this country in particular, where for a couple of months some of us took a hiatus from the news. Now we're apt to get behind if we take a day off and go skiing. This isn't, of course, a bad thing, but I think it's prudent that we do not shy from the current charge in the air, and instead summon the fortitude and the courage to face what's going on, even in here, in a morning worship service, in this sanctuary, with our faith as our guide and Jesus as our witness. This is the stuff that always got him going. Questions of faith in context, faith in action, justice and mercy played out in the laws and the prevailing political powers of the day. So we have before us this morning two very different approaches to dealing with wrongdoing. First, we heard the venomous injunction to vengeance in Leviticus, fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It is entirely appropriate to view this with suspicion, to recoil from this vindictive, to protest its cruelty. We do not stone people to death. We strive not to have different laws for different races. We reject as racist and abhorrent this behavior. And then we hear Jesus, as plain as a daisy in June, saying that there should be, in effect, no end to forgiveness. How many times shall we forgive those who do evil against us? Peter asks. Seven times? Not seven times, Jesus says, but I tell you, 70 times seven. Two biblical passages that seem to contradict each other. So what are we to make of this? Putting aside questions of how we read the Bible, we are left with two irreconcilable opposites. And then we hear the letter from Ephesians calling the people, calling all of us to realize that we are one body, one people, not separate, independent individuals, but part of the same system, the same body. This is a familiar image, isn't it? The image of a body. The church from earliest times has been called the body of Christ. Jesus took the bread in what may seem very perplexing to those around him, said, "This is my body." But it looked like a loaf of bread. Maybe what he was saying is that we are all bound together in a system of mutuality that feeds and nourishes and grows and expands and lives and dies and replenishes and is reborn. And that the connective tissue that binds it all together, the yeast, the culture, the glue that makes the atoms adhere to one another, is God's love and forgiveness. And unless we affirm the holy, blessed, and created fabric and system and network of existence, we will not thrive. So let's pause for a moment and have an anatomy lesson. We all have bodies, and they are comprised of systems and parts. Our whole bodies are actually a compilation, a great gathering together of a lot of smaller things, cells and particles. We are composed of tiny parts, electrons and neutrons and protons, atoms functioning in a system within a larger frame. And the frame is our bodies. We have circulatory systems and digestive systems and cardiovascular and endocrine and immune and nervous and lymphatic and reproductive and respiratory. You get the drift. We use energy and we release it, and it goes out to become building blocks of other matter within the larger system of our house or town or state or country or world or universe. Begging the indulgence of the doctors and scientists among us, matter is essentially connected energy, atoms fused together. It happens in tiny, infinitesimal ways within our bodies and without, in systems that function together. There is an interdependence in the created physical world that just as there is within our bodies. Rob Bell talks about this brilliantly, applying the image of the body to our political system as well. We are being summoned right now, I think, to a political anatomy class. Maybe you're recognizing, as I am, that you don't really know how this system of our government works at all. I'm realizing this because I am suddenly paying attention. I admit that for a while this winter, I wasn't really paying attention at all. I was perfectly happy watching Mozart in the Jungle and The Crown and not thinking about the larger system in which we live. If truth be known, I've been guilty of this for a while. In the past 8 years, I tended to defer to the powers that be. I trusted that things would be okay, that really smart people were watching the store, and the last thing they needed was my little head. So I suspected at times that this wasn't true, but I would just claim ignorance and turn away. Not anymore. Suddenly, many of us are saying, "Hang on a minute, I don't understand." And we're asking questions with little care for their revealing ignorance, because right now things are charged and critical. What power, for instance, does the executive branch actually have? Can the president issue executive orders on some things but not others? What jurisdiction do state and federal courts have? How can a judge in Washington state steal an executive order that affects the whole country? When can Congress step up? Does anyone have a job description for the FBI? And to whom do they report? And what are the rules of diplomacy? And the emolument clause? Where's my copy of the Constitution? Many of us are suddenly full of questions about how our government works, and this is really healthy. And I have to say that it's kind of about time, isn't it? We are engaged and curious and generating a lot of energy in our little system. One of the things that is dawning on us is the truth expressed in Ephesians. We are all in this together. Some people may want to say, not my president, but you know what? He is our president because we are part of this nation. So unless you actually emigrate and leave, we are in this together. Imagine that you are told that you have something wrong with your body. You have an infection or a cancer, God forbid, and your immediate reaction is not going to be, I don't like it, so I don't care. It's not my problem, because of course, you'll quickly be on WebMed.com trying to learn all you can about what's going on inside your body. And the same is being asked of us as people of faith, to view our lives, our very existence, as held within a created, blessed universe, tiny parts of a large galaxy, Milky Way, solar system, planet, country, state, county, town, neighborhood, church, family. Little integral parts of the larger system. Just as our bodies are made up of tiny parts, so we are all part of larger systems as well. And the cohesive functioning of these systems is dependent, I would suggest, on the grace of God and on our ability to live the love of Jesus made real in compassion and love and forgiveness. I know of no greater example of this than that which was lived out in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa. What happened between the rush to vengeance and the deliberate, patient, and compassionate act of forgiveness in South Africa was fused energy of love and the clear recognition that until they affirmed their shared humanity over the pull to vengeance, they could not go on. What is still shocking to me is the idea that a whole nation could choose forgiveness over vengeance. I can imagine an individual here and there having the remarkable faith or whatever it takes to forgive someone, but it is difficult to imagine forgiveness as a national policy, especially these days. The premise on which the commission was based was that South Africa could not begin to heal, could not move forward from the evil grip of apartheid if it set about trying its own. So they chose forgiveness over vengeance and granted amnesty to the perpetrators who had acted on the government's behalf. Against what might seem like conventional wisdom, the commission was established to hear the stories of the people, the victims and the perpetrators. Amnesty was available, but only on the condition that those who applied for it disclosed fully the facts of misdeeds that could fairly have been characterized as having had a political objective. As Martha Minow says in her wonderful book, Between Vengeance and Forgiveness, trading truth for amnesty and amnesty for truth, the commission was intended to promote the gathering of facts and the basis for society to move towards a democratic future. Without adequate reparation and rehabilitation, there can be no healing and no reconciliation, either at an individual or a community level. So the government made restitution to the victims, accepting responsibility and diffusing the fractious scythe of individual litigation. Because the country was not wealthy, the money actually paid out was minimal, but it was worth a fortune. So many things are startling to me about this concept, and it's not without its problems, but it was an astounding moment when a nation so torn and bloodied chose forgiveness. listening for almost 2 years to the sordid details of torture, 2 years and cruelty, the commission marveled at the frailty of humanity. Archbishop Tutu observed, "It is important to note that those guilty of these abuses were ordinary folk. They did not grow horns on their foreheads or have tails hidden in their trousers. They looked just like you and me." Though their testimony presented one side of the picture, the other side, the victim's side, was what sustained everyone. There were many, many people who by rights should have been filled with bitterness because of the untold and unnecessary suffering that they had endured. Instead, they were to demonstrate a remarkable generosity of spirit and almost unprecedented magnanimity in their willingness to forgive those who had tormented them. Forgiving someone doesn't mean that you are suddenly well. It doesn't mean that awful things haven't happened, but it does mean that you recognize in them a shared humanity. It's worth remembering this because we have such a hard time forgiving ourselves, believing that God forgives us. Precisely because of our failings, we need others and we need God. There is a pernicious character of oppression and abuse. I suspect that we have all experienced it to a greater or lesser degree. If we are told often enough that we're no good, we will come over time to believe it. Women who have been abused physically or emotionally in a twist of fate often defer to their abusers and assume in their heart of hearts that they are worthless. For small girls, this is especially destructive, for their worldview from an early age is one of brokenness. And as they grow, it is familiar to them. Sorrow is their comfort zone. Forgiveness and confession make the future possible. Confession becomes the perpetrator's step towards the future. Tutu uses the following analogy to illustrate the need for confession. Imagine that you are sitting in a dank, stuffy, dark room. This is because the curtains are drawn and the windows have been shut. Outside, the light is shining and a fresh breeze is blowing. If you want the light to stream into the room and the fresh air to flow on you, you will have to open the window and draw the curtains apart, and then the light, which has always been available, will come in and air will enter the room to freshen it up. So it is with forgiveness. When we speak of our failings, when we confess, when we rise from the dank room and throw open the window, we are blessed and choose tomorrow over yesterday. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission first and foremost listened to stories, heard the gruesome, unmentionable details of torture and agony. They honored all who had suffered by the great gift of listening. They couldn't change what had happened, but they could offer compassion, which means literally, of course, compassion, to suffer with. One woman told of how she was tortured while in detention. She was raped repeatedly. She said that she survived by taking her spirit out of her body and putting it in the corner of the cell in which she was being raped. She could then, disembodied in this manner, look on as they did all those awful things to her body, intending to make her hate herself just as they had told her she would. By doing this, she could then imagine that it was not she herself, but a stranger who was suffering the ignominy. With tears in her eyes, she said that she had not yet gone back to the room to fetch her soul, and that it was still sitting in the corner where she'd left it. The African concept of community, Ubuntu, was embraced by Archbishop Tutu and provided the commission's theological underpinnings. It is a theology of interdependence founded on habitual recalling of the image of God in the midst of human conflict. We need each other. We are different, but we are all part of a larger whole. We can be human only in community and in peace, and only God can bring us together. Ubuntu seeks to restore the oppressor's humanity by releasing and enabling the oppressed to see their peers as children of God. This mutuality is not possible when vengeance and anger rage over forgiveness and compassion. At its heart, Ubuntu affirms our differences and our need for each other and the glorious future that is ours when we recognize our interdependence. So can you imagine a national policy of Ubuntu in the United States? Just recall the mercy and forgiveness offered to Dylan Roof by the family members of the 9 victims of Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in South Carolina, whom Mr. Roof had gunned down at the Bible study. This is what Paul calls us to do, to aspire towards, to unleash from within our small, frightened, and beating hearts. So what are we waiting for? Must we be flung against eternity's door before we trust God's ability to bring us together, before we recognize the beauty and cohesive nature of the created universe? Might we be able, with God's eternal blessing, to open the window to forgiveness, and dare I say, the window to truth? Can we learn to speak of that which haunts us and apologize to those we've wronged and forgive those who have hurt us and proclaim truth to power? This is the path to tomorrow, yours and mine, tiny parts that we are within the larger whole. Jesus walks this bumpy road with us, the road between vengeance and forgiveness, between silence and voice, between fear and trust, and seeks always to liberate broken spirits for the future of promise. But when needs be, he will hover in the corner with a soul abandoned in a dark room, pure and chaste for a brighter tomorrow. On a cold winter night, God will light a moon for all whose moons have been blackened, and if necessary, God will push our wheelchairs over to the window of forgiveness and part the curtains and open the door and weep for our broken hearts and let the fresh air of forgiveness and love cleanse our hearts, beating as one in this body we all call home. Grace and peace.